In 1979, November, when the U.S. Embassy in Iran was taken over, ABC News began covering the story on a late-night show. And at first, it starred one of their veteran newsmen, Frank Reynolds. And eventually, Ted Koppel joined the show as a co-host, and then eventually the show morphed into, and you'd see it at, well, where we were, 11 o'clock every night. I'm Ted Koppel. This is Nightline. Or something like that. Maybe that's not the best Ted Koppel with the hair. I don't have the hair. You know, he had massive hair. Ted Koppel was the host of Nightline. That became an institution for America for many, many years when there were only three networks. I think I watched it almost every night. And they had a countdown in the Iran hostage. You know, they went up into the 300s. Night 376, September 20th. And it kept going on until the election of 1980. And then when President Reagan took office, all the hostages were released. Now, Ted Koppel continued that show on through the 80s and into the 90s. I think it was like 1995 when he finally left the show and went to another network, did something for public television or something. But he had another frequent guest who was really interesting. I'm not going to mention him now. I'll mention him a little bit later in the sermon. But see if you can guess who I'm thinking about at any time and write it down and then come up and tell me, I knew who you were talking about. Because I always love that. But I'm thinking of a frequent guest that he had. See if you can figure it out and write it down in your notes as proof, okay? All right, moving on. We didn't know it then, but the 1980s was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Remember the Cold War as versus a heated war where people are actually attacking one another? The Cold War was all spy games and intrigue and behind-the-scenes maneuvering and all of that sort of thing that was going on between the USSR and the United States. Remember the Cold War? I remember growing up during the Cold War. I remember we did bomb blast drills in the hallways of our elementary school in 1958 when I was in first grade. They'd have a bomb drill. Like, okay, we live 50 miles from Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. was kind of thought to be a target. And we had our missiles pointed at them. They had their missiles pointed at us. We know they did. And we know we did. We've got the Titan missiles in Green Valley and all across southern Arizona to basically the Cold War. We had all these missiles, you know, mutually assured destruction, or the acronym MAD. Remember those days? They ended in the 1980s. We didn't know they were going to end in the 1980s, but they did. A lot of people attribute it to a number of individuals that came on the scene at that time. President Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Pope John Paul II, and even Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet leader. All of them had an important part in ending the Cold War. And then eventually, you know what happened? The Iron Curtain came down. The Iron Curtain was what Winston Churchill said descended upon Europe, split Europe in the middle with the Soviet bloc of nations. And then even East Germany and West Germany were separated by a wall. And when I was growing up as a kid, when we were all growing up as kids, this was a real thing where people were trying to escape from East Germany and they'd be shot in the no man's land between the two nations. Do you remember that? Who remembers that? Okay, so that's kind of discouraging. Most of the audience is raising their hands. Shows you're at least as old as I am. Anyway, Margaret Thatcher admired President Reagan and vice versa. Pope John Paul II was Polish, and he urged the Soviet bloc to release his homeland. And then there was a leader who was a trade union guy, Lech Walesa, in Poland, who actually rose to become prime minister of Poland later on. But Poland became free, And it was all done. The Cold War was over by the end of the 80s for the basic part. And we thought, okay, there's this emergence of something that has to happen on the scene now, but it didn't happen. And you know what I'm talking about. We thought that when that Cold War was over and when Europe was kind of reunited, Eastern Bloc, Western Bloc, all the European nations that were a part of the Soviet bloc from World War II on were released, we thought, huh, this may be the beginning of the rise of a power called the Beast in Revelation 13. We thought that might be the instigator. The point of this history lesson is that many of us in the church 37 years ago, up to 40 years ago, thought that the removal of the Berlin Wall that separated and was kind of a separation, At any rate, it served as a parallel between the separation of Eastern and Western Europe, but the separation of the wall that divided Berlin was symbolic. That's the word I was searching for. Symbolic of the separation of Eastern and West Europe. And we thought, when that all collapsed, now paves the way for a united Europe, right? Okay, I'm not the only one who thought that, am I? We did think that, didn't we? Didn't we? Okay, thanks. We're very reassuring. Sometimes it's hard to predict how things are going to end up. It really is. My friend Paul Smith in San Diego quoted Dean Wilson, another longtime minister, said the Church of God has been good at predicting prophecy that's already happened. We're not so good on the prophecy in the future. Prophecy doesn't always follow what we think is the logical conclusion. Am I safe ground there? It's kind of like when I was in the Boy Scouts, roaming around in the Catoctin Mountains. You can look that up, try to find out where that is if you don't know. They had a lot of trails. And sometimes in the Boy Scouts, I mean, we're little, 8, 9 years old, so not the best sense of direction, 8 or 9 years old. We're in the forest, and we're on trails, and they have trails all over the Catoctin Mountains and parks and everything. There's Camp David's there, too. But we're roaming around as little kids on the Catoctin Mountain Loop Trail, and without really taking a lot of different, you know, sharp rights, 90-degree turns or everything, eventually you'd end up back at the same place because the trail was a loop. It was just a big loop. And under the forest canopy, and because an 8 or 9 year old doesn't really have the greatest sense of direction, I said Boy Scouts, I meant Cub Scouts. That's how it's Cub Scouts. We have campouts there as Cub Scouts. But Cub Scouts are younger than Boy Scouts. But anyway, we didn't have the greatest sense of direction. Under the forest canopy in the summertime, you don't really see the sun all that much. And so we looped around, came right back to the same place. It's kind of difficult to figure that you'd end up back at the same place where you started after you'd walked a mile or two, or what seemed like a mile or two. Maybe it was only a couple of hundred yards. It always seems longer when you're a little kid. Or it's like prophecy is sometimes as difficult to understand as a putt in golf. I know I've got everybody's attention now. I'm talking about golf. We had a saying among some that I played. I had to catch on pretty quickly. If I was playing in a partner-type match with one of my friends against somebody else at Tucson Country Club, and I was just starting out there, and they had a lot of sloping greens, and then you'd look at where the ball was and where the hole was, and you'd wonder, which way does it break? You know, because on slopes, balls go in certain directions, right? And you have to be accurate, you have to know, okay, which way does it break? Because it's hard to tell. And so some wise guy would say, it breaks towards the mountains. Well, in Tucson, everywhere you turn, there's mountains. So which way does it break? It was a joke, okay? Maybe not a very good one, but it was a joke. I think because of some of the failed expectations of prophecy in the past, some have come to dismiss or lose interest in Bible prophecy altogether. I really believe that that is true. Some people have just put it off to the side. This failed, this failed, this failed, all this failed. Again, we haven't been real good at predicting the immediate future. But I write a newsletter, and I like Bible prophecy, and I try to come up with something every week. It stimulates me. It interests me, and I've learned a few things about what happens in watching world events that I'd like to share with you today. As you continue in your Christian journey, I really believe that it's an important aspect of your Bible study. And as I always do, I will have some personal opinions, and it's up to the audience to separate personal opinions from the Bible. And we've always had these personal opinions. It's just that 40 years ago when we said Europe was going to reunite, it wasn't just a personal opinion. It was fact! Because the minister said it. Remember those days? So the title today is Four Prophetic Principles. Call them four prophetic keys if you wish. Actually, that's what I've got in my notes, but I changed it in my own head to principles. Four prophetic principles. My purpose is to, I think I'm helping you understand the Bible better. I hope I will. That's my theory at any rate. Let's see if it works. So my purpose is to help you to understand the Bible better and Bible prophecy better by the application of four principles. Now, these principles are no more important than the sermon I gave on seven prophetic keys a couple of months ago, or the three keys to understanding prophecy a year or two ago, or the two vital elements to prophecy I gave 5 years ago, or 10 steps to understanding prophecy 20 years ago. That's a joke, too. Let's review a couple of passages about prophecy before I get to point number one. And I'd like to raise a question. And the question is, have we sometimes been guilty of putting a square peg into the round hole of prophecy? Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3 is a passage about prophecy that I have read and I've heard expounded from the pulpit since I came to the Church of God in 1971. And certainly I heard a lot about it when I went to Ambassador College as well. But 2 Timothy chapter 3. Now, if you've been around the church for very long, you know that this prophecy was fulfilled in 1965 and 1975 and 1985, 95 and 2005 and 2015 too, right? I'm just raising the question, have we sometimes been guilty of putting the square peg into the round hole of prophetic understanding? Bear with me. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good. Well, am I wrong in suggesting that if you pick any decade that you would like, you could probably find a way to make that come true way back when? Am I wrong? Am I the only one that is thinking? Am I the only one that's... No, I know I'm not the only one, but bear with me now. I'm not saying that some of these elements haven't been true throughout all of our adult lives, but I'm just simply suggesting that time changes, society changes, the world changes. But was this true 40 years ago in the way that Paul intended it to be for the last days? Was it? Maybe it is. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Do a few arrogant people, a few disrespectful teens, a few people who are rude and unthankful, don't keep Thanksgiving anymore, do they fulfill a prophecy? Or is this one that we could perhaps put on the shelf and wait a little bit? Just a suggestion. The New American Standard Version says of this verse, "But understand this, there will be terrifying times in the last days." Fear is maybe a subjective evaluation. I'm not seeing terrifying times in the decades I've been in the church, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000, and the most recent decade that we're living in now. It says people will be self-centered and lovers of money, proud, haughty, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, irreligious, callous, implacable, slanderous, licentious, brutal, hating what is good. The last phrase is interesting. People will hate what is good, and maybe that is a key to understanding the fulfillment ultimately of this prophecy in its final form. Well, it also says that we'll hate people who do good. Hate people who do good. And we may be at that point now. So I'm willing to entertain that thought. Let's take another look. Let's take a look at another passage about prophecy, about the days and the times of the end prior to Christ's return. And that is in 2 Peter chapter 3. Now, at the end of the message today, I'm going to come back to both of these passages with some additional information. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1, it uses similar phrasing as Paul did. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1, "I now write to you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation." As I take it, not something expressed verbally, out loud, that somebody would actually make this statement, or that they would capture this quote, they'd actually come out, someone prominent, and say it. I take it that that is a general attitude of the time period in which Paul or Peter is speaking about here. So it's expressing, in my feeling is, it expresses the actions of people who are disregarding the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. It's kind of what they're saying by the way they live. So I'm going to come back and I'm going to try to tie those two passages together at the end, at the conclusion today. So now I'm going to give you the first principle that I think, and there's so many valid, good principles to evaluate Bible prophecy, but this is one that I'm giving you today, and I think it is so important. And the principle is very simple. It is the law. The principle of the law is an important aspect in evaluating Bible prophecy, or the times of the end, the times before God intervenes, the day of the Lord, all of that. The law. And whether we're talking about civil law in this country, which for the most part is based on the Ten Commandments, or whether we're talking about the law of God, in some ways, they're kind of interchangeable. But I just want to emphasize to you the principle of law. And I hope I don't have to break that down any further and, you know, talk about all the nonsensical laws that man has created and all the laws that are passed all the time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's break it down to what we spoke about a few weeks ago, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, based basically on the Bible. I think we know that. I believe that this is an important principle, and it may be one of the most important of all in understanding the end times, the last days. This scripture coming up, Isaiah 8:20, we have applied in many ways to religious bodies. Probably we should. But Isaiah 8 and verse 20 is a very important scripture passage about the law, and it is something that, again, we've applied it to churches and evaluating true churches and all that sort of thing. And all of that is true. But if our nation is important in terms of Bible prophecy, and I believe that it is, and I believe the descendants of Abraham are important in Bible prophecy, the sons of Jacob, the descendants of Jacob, the remnant of Jacob, how it is mentioned, Israel, Jacob, Joseph, Manasseh, all through the Old Testament. I believe all of those are important. They describe the descendants. They describe promises of greatness and wealth and national greatness and all that sort of thing, which we've covered. And those things are real. I mean, you just can't get away from that in Bible prophecy. But Isaiah 8 and verse 20 says, "To the law and the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, it's because there's no light in them." It's a way of evaluating churches. You know, do they emphasize the law or not? Do they? We sure do. We emphasize the law. It's a very important part. We believe in the Ten Commandments. In the 1960s, the United States went through some turbulent times, and I lived it. I was a kid. I mean, I was growing up as a kid, but it was turbulent. And it's easy to see retrospectively why the Church of God thought things were coming to a mighty conclusion. Losing a war in Vietnam, demonstrations, which we'd never had in society before, public demonstrations. I mean, not to the extent. The 1960s were, I mean, for those of us that were growing up in that time, they were kind of revolutionary and mind-boggling for us to witness what was going on TV night by night. That was young people protesting the establishment. "Yeah, man, we're against you." You know, the people of that time and age. And what happened to them? What happened to those? And they're all baby boomers. Big generation. Now aging. Some not so gracefully. The baby boomers. That was my generation. Many of these baby boomers, maybe even some of the protesters, some of them, but a lot of those boomers, as they're called now, they got conservative. They got educated. And they got jobs. And they had families. And they grew up Republican. And they aspired for a better life for their own children. Many of them did. And the rest went to work for the government. Do we need the laugh track here again? In 1968, Richard Nixon was elected president. And in the best-selling book, The Greatest Comeback, Pat Buchanan, no relation, but I lovingly call him Uncle Pat. Pat Buchanan, who was one of Nixon's closest confidants and associates and worked in his cabinet, worked as an administrative press secretary for President Nixon, detailed in the book, The Greatest Comeback, published a few years ago, how Nixon rose from his defeat at the hand of John Kennedy in 1960 and all through the 1960s. Nixon was a peacemaker in the Republican Party. He brought together the wings of conservatives and the blue bloods from the Northeast, and he amalgamated a constituency. And at the right time, the silent majority, which was the greatest generation, was kind of getting fed up with all the rebelliousness of us. The baby boomers who are out protesting in the streets and carrying placards. I didn't do this. I'm sure none of you did. But carrying placards. And in 1968, a bunch of them went to Chicago, where the Democrat National Convention was. They protested at that convention. And, you know, looking back now, it's so illogical. Because even then, the Democrat Party was the liberal party. Now, they were more like the Republican Party of today, to be honest. But they were the liberal wing of American politics. And here these protesters were out protesting against the Democrat Party. Maybe they were onto something. The mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, sent in the police to disperse the protesters. The tactics got a bit too harsh, and they cracked a bunch of young skulls full of mush. I don't know if those of you that are my age remember that, but it was a massive demonstration of police brutality. It really was, because these were mostly peaceful demonstrations, not like the ones that we've seen recently in our nation. And we weren't, as a society, used to having any kind of demonstrations. And so people were fed up against demonstrations against the Vietnam War. They're fed up of all of these young people who had never held a job, many of them, except maybe a part-time job as a dishwasher in a restaurant, like I did. The silent majority reacted powerfully. And Nixon was elected president on the platform of law and order. It will be interesting to see if my generation reacts in the same way now, this year. We'll see. There was a funny quote by Mayor Daley when he was questioned about the police and their harsh tactics and their billy clubs and cracking skulls. He said, "The police aren't there to create disorder. The police are there to preserve disorder." He really said that. And it was a funny misspeak by the mayor, but it described the issue that society was facing at the time. They reacted kind of violently. In those days of the 1960s, these demonstrations, sometimes they were peaceful, sometimes they resulted in large crowds assembling to hear Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It's estimated that at the National Mall, I think it is, there are like 500,000 people that were assembled there to hear that speech. And sometimes in those days, the protests were against real problems of racial injustice and the war, racism, sometimes. But law and order won the day. So be kind of hard-pressed to say that some of the things that Paul was telling Timothy and that Peter was saying were actually happening because of a little bit of what we called rebellion at that time, in that day and age. When you're evaluating Bible prophecy, law may be one of the things that you want to keep uppermost in mind, and the principle of law in society and how it is respected or not. And lately we've been seeing that there is some disrespect for law and disrespect for, well, I won't say disrespect for authority, because there is an authority that is respected, and sometimes that authority is an authority that also disrespects the law. So is the tide turning? Maybe too early to say. Which way is society going? Use law as a basis for evaluating. Note what it says in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 11. Matthew 24 and verse 11, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will wax cold. It kind of goes hand in hand. The respect for law and love, a lot of people see a division there. But law and love go hand in hand together. And when people hate law, and they hate those who support the law, and they hate law enforcement, maybe we're heading in that direction. Because despite the fact that I lived and grew up in the 60s and saw those turbulent times and changes in society as a result of it, eventually these baby boomers, for the most part, got themselves, many of us did, we got ourselves straightened out, and we taught those same values of law, respect for authority that our parents had taught us. It didn't catch on with a few, and again, they went to work for the government. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. This also talks about law and its importance in a society. Its importance in society. Which shows us that even in Paul's day, lawlessness was beginning. Now, Paul is speaking about a lawlessness toward the law of God, but in many times in our society, it's kind of interchangeable. Respect for God's law, respect for man's law that are good and right and appropriate and based on the Bible and designed to keep a society functioning in good order. Those are good laws if they help people, if they support the individual, if they support individual rights and protect individual rights. All those laws can be good. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 6, it says, and now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Yep, there was an anti-law aspect that was beginning in religion in the Church of God at that time. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way, and then the lawless one will be revealed. What this is talking about is that there is going to appear on the scene a religious leader who hates law, strangely enough, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Going to have some powers. That's why we know that this is speaking about a false prophet. More on that in a little bit. But the rebellion against law and order has always been there. Okay? It's always been there. It's been there since the Garden of Eden, because man wants to go in his own direction without divine intervention from God or divine revelation from God. That's kind of the natural order of things, because we have a God of this world that constantly bombards with that attitude, anti-law, anti-God. But this lawlessness has got to be coupled with something else in order for it to be the last times, the last days. And I'm going to show you that at the end. The second thing I think is important for you to evaluate, and maybe this is not going to make sense to you or maybe somebody, maybe it will. Evaluate people. Evaluate people. You have to do this in an honest way, not trying to make the square peg fit into the round hole of prophecy. You really have to understand people and understand societies and nations and what moves them and motivates them. And rather than getting it from the 40,000-foot view of the news media, that's something you can do, right? I would encourage you to do it on the ground level, with the people you know, with the people that are your neighbors, the clerks at the store. Wait a minute, you can't do that anymore because you can't go to the store. You have to have everything delivered by Safeway. You can't tell who people are because they're all wearing masks. Roger Ward Babson. I'll repeat it for those of you that like to do your own research. Roger Ward Babson was an American economist and statistician. He was notable for founding a school for both men and women. It was one of the first business schools of its kind in the United States. And it offered courses in finance, production, distribution, and personal efficiency. He was an economist and a statistician, and he was actually, if you've heard the name before and you think you've heard the name before, you could be right. Because he was quoted by Herbert Armstrong in his autobiography, because he predicted a crash, an economic crash in the early 1920s. And he also predicted the crash in 1929, but nobody believed him. But he believed in himself. He predicted it. No one else. Everybody is buying stocks, you know, borrowing money to buy stocks. Stocks were shooting up. Boom, boom, boom. And he said, get out of the market. And he was right. One of the quotes from Roger Babson is, a character standard is far more important than a gold standard. The success of all economic systems is still dependent upon both righteous leaders and righteous people. In the last analysis, our national future depends upon our national character, that is, whether it is spiritually or materially minded. Okay, polls are good. Surveys can be good. You're going to hear those things about the nature of people in our country. You're going to hear those things. But I encourage you to do this. Do your own research and learn about people, because people are very interesting. Learn about the people, not just the people in the church, but the people on the ground level that you come in contact with. Are the majority of people dishonest or are they honest? Are they law-abiding or are they not? Turn off the news for a little bit. Turn off the protests and the information where it makes it seem like 75 or 80% of the people are out there rioting in the streets, throwing bricks through windows, because it's coming at you so often it makes you feel that way. Wow, I didn't realize, you know, you back up the camera. Sometimes it's thousands, but sometimes you back up the camera, there's just a few people. It makes it look like there's a lot. But even if there is a lot, that doesn't mean it represents the majority of society or the world. The quote I gave you from Roger Babson isn't the one that Herbert Armstrong used, but it's close. The one he quoted was his citation of Babson's theory on how many people conducted their affairs in honesty. And he said that if 50% or more of the people are honest in conducting their affairs, the country will promise. If 50% or more are dishonest, the country is not going to prosper. So that's, I think, basically tells us how society works. There are going to be thousands of people in prison, but they're in prison for a reason. They're kind of not in society. There can be a lot of bad things going on out there. I realize that. But does that make a whole society? You have to be the judge of that. This is just a key for you. Evaluate people. Sometimes the national news is a good barometer of people. Maybe sometimes it's not. It's a challenge. Evaluate leaders. Which ones are honest? And here's a tip. And I've heard this since I came into the church, because we were always apolitical. Both sides are wrong. Okay, this country is divided, you know, 50% Democrat, 50%. I'm just using this for an example. 50% here, 50% there, or give or take a few percentages. You know, people used to say, both sides are wrong. That's not true. Both sides are not always wrong. This is called And this is one that I like to pick out and pick at because I'm so contrarian when it comes to this. I'm so skeptical when it comes to this. And I'm not saying that you should be as skeptical as I am, but I am very skeptical. I was taught to question things early on in my education, and you know, I had some great teachers, and they wanted you to be skeptical so that you would come to a firm conclusion, even if they were being skeptical about good standards. Okay, that's one of the things. I had a public education, but sometimes you'd get that rare teacher that would have you be skeptical for the right reason. So it's just ingrained in me. So I don't mean to be contrarian or skeptical, but I do question things. Okay, so what I'm talking about is applying moral equivalency, you know, because nobody's perfect. And so when we're in the church, of course, we're all perfect and everybody else is imperfect, right? But, okay, in evaluating the world, it's not all cut and dried. They're all bad. We learned that a long time ago. The whole world isn't bad. There are some good people. So not both sides. The argument that both sides are wrong is false. Now, if you want to challenge me in the chat, feel free. I mean, because I'm not claiming to be the expert. I'm trying to get you to be stimulated to think. Because sometimes there are people who believe in law, and you can't say that they are in the same camp as those who don't believe in the law. Okay? That's all I'm saying. There are some people, some leaders, some people who do believe in the administration of law, which goes back to that very important point. Now, this, you thought I got controversial already? Boy, I'm going to really rock your world now. Because I want to explain to you, not that I have great affinity for the president, but I would like to explain to you, and you can either accept it or reject it because I'm not claiming to be God's prophet. I want to explain to you why the president is so hated. People say, I don't like him because he tweets. Okay, maybe he shouldn't tweet as much. I don't like him because of his hairstyle. It is rather flamboyant, isn't it? I don't like him because he's orange. Okay, well, sometimes, I don't know if he eats a lot of carrots or what, I don't know. I don't like him because he's rude. Well, he is rude. I mean, I'm just being honest. He brags. I don't like him because he brags. His opponents, now I don't mean those of you that kind of like the job he's doing, but you don't like, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about all the people who say they hate the man. And it could be any man, but he's the president, so let's just pick on him right now. There is an absolute hatred which goes beyond the scale of hatred. It is a vehemence. And a hatred that began even before many people even knew him. Now, how many of you have ever known people from New York? I've known people. Then, I mean, New York City. You worked there for a while. I had a trainer when I was in Eli Lilly, the first training course that I went to from Eli Lilly. I'm from the Southwest. I came from the East. I knew some New Yorkers back East. He's from New York. And my friend Steve Walden, you knew this guy too. His name was Mark. We won't say his last name. But he became a trainer. And he trained us. And we're in Indianapolis, which is kind of the Mideast, right? The Midwest, Mideast. We're sitting there. He's a trainer from New York. And I never had a ride along with any representatives from New York when they go to see their customers and everything. But Stephen and I can say that because we've both done the same type of job, when we go see our customers, we're pretty respectful of them because we know they have an MD after their name. We know that they spent a great deal of their time learning their craft. And so we approach them with respect, even if the guy's a jerk. we approach them with respect that is, and some are, come on. Some were. Not all of them are great now. That's the way I evaluate it. But this trainer was teaching his entire class of 30 new representatives, you've got to hold your doctors accountable for what they say they're going to do. Have you ever had people like that in your company tell you the same thing? And I just walked away and I said, okay, that's the way he did things. It doesn't work in Tucson or Yuma or El Paso, Sierra Vista. That's not how we approach. No, you got to stand up to them. You got to tell them the way it is. You got to tell them to do this. No, not so much. But that is a different mindset. That's a common thing. To be forceful, to be what we would call pushy, and that is the president. It's not, they hate him, not because he's arrogant or braggadocio or bad hairstyle or tweeting. I'll tell you why. I'm going to, you know, and you can disagree with me on this. Okay, I don't mind people disagreeing because you may have an honest dislike for other reasons. I don't know. But if you think that's why they tried for 4 years, first of all, to prevent him from being elected in the first place, and then for the last all these years of his presidency trying to get him out of office because they don't like some of those things, then you are, I don't know if I can help you. But why do they really hate him? Because he supports the law. That's it. He loves the flag. As rude, arrogant, or whatever his misgivings or failures are, we all have them, right? Some men's sins go out before them, and some men's sins trail behind them. Isn't that what Paul told Timothy? But he wants to enforce the law. He wanted to enforce illegal immigration laws that were on the books. That's basically the primary foundation of his first election. That's what got him elected, because people agreed with that. So evaluate people, point two. Point three, evaluate yourself. Evaluate yourself. Yep. Turn to Luke 21 and verse 34. Evaluate yourself. Luke 21:34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life. And I believe that carousing and drunkenness are probably synonyms for an attitude of life, of just not taking it seriously, not taking the times seriously, not taking your calling seriously. Of course, it could mean carousing and drunkenness are not good things, obviously, right? But I believe it's a spiritual synonym that it's really speaking about in how you react to your calling and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Evaluate yourself continually. Whether you're in the faith, as Paul told Corinth, stay close to God. Ask him to search you and your heart. Psalm 139 and verse 23. Psalm 139 and verse 23, there are many passages that are similar to this one that you could invoke upon yourself. Do a little research, do a little search in your Bibles. You'll find a number of them say something very similar to this. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Psalm 139:23, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties, and see if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Point number three, evaluate yourself. Short point. Last point. 4 points, four laps. We're going to complete a mile here. Three words in this last point. Media, state, church. Media, state, church. I have not put these ever together until recently. In understanding that all three are necessary components. I mentioned the fall of the Soviet Union, or the Iron Curtain being taken down, the Berlin Wall being broken down, the Germanys being reunited, the Soviet bloc of European nations coming back into Europe and not in the Soviet hemisphere any longer. That took place in the 80s and through the 90s. Why did Europe not come together as the beast power at that time? These three areas weren't working in concert together. You had Pope John Paul II from the most powerful Christian church in the world, who was a gentle man. You know, I'll just say it. He was a great man. He was a kind man. He wanted to see his country freed from the Soviet orbit. He was a reformer. He was great. But he did a lot. And he had a lot of good things that he did. I mean, kind, gentle soul. But the media, church, and state were not working together. Now, this is a personal opinion, and, you know, there's room here in my world for disagreement. Okay? Because I realize there have been so many things that we have failed on in projecting as what's going to happen in the future that I'd better label an opinion as an opinion rather than a dogmatic statement. Just the way my mind works, it's a personal opinion. Because I believe in this current crisis that we've been going through that the real lesson for students of the Bible in regards to COVID-19 virus isn't a message to get our attention. I believe there's something else working here, or something else that maybe you can work it here. And the reason I do that is just because, again, I am a skeptic. I look back in the 14th century. There are 75 million people that were killed by the bubonic plague. That was horrible. It wiped out 60% of Europe's population. Where was the message then? I don't know of any. I don't think there's anything in the Bible that those people had to learn. It was just living in this world and having unsanitary conditions and not knowing what caused it. And those poor people, many of them died. They didn't know what to think or do about it. They, you know, maybe they were very superstitious about it, but can you name one plague in history that has come from God, except for a time in Israel when David made a mistake and God allowed a plague? I mean, are there any others that I'm missing? I don't think this is of God, okay? That's just my opinion. You can have your opinion. I meant to bring the book that you lent me today because I've read it until I'm so discouraged I don't want to read it anymore. Mr. Tannert gave me a book on the Spanish influenza. 100 years ago, it killed 100 million people. 100 million people. Was there some message that the world was supposed to? And, you know, in this country, life went on. There wasn't anything mentioned about it. That was 100 years ago. 100 million people was a significant portion of the world's population. Life went on, commerce went on. I don't think there was a message from God then. And every year, do you realize this? Every year, the regular flu has anywhere from 40 to 80,000 people die in this country. And nobody talks about that. So, here's what I think. And it's, don't get me wrong, I'm not discounting it. I'm not saying this virus is a scam or anything like that, because people are going to hospitals, people get sick. I think a lot of it is exaggerated. You'll never know the real numbers. You'll never understand what is actually happening out there, because it's become a political football, believe it or not. I think the real lesson here to be learned is an important lesson for the future. And that is that when the media and the state get together and they proclaim a message, people obey. People obey. And that brings us back to, I'm Ted Koppel, and this is Nightline. Did you write down the frequent guest? You're too young, way back there in the back. You guys, you didn't even know there was such a thing as TV when the times that I'm speaking of, so I'm discounting you. But all the rest of you that are older, can you think of that frequent guest? I'd like to find out if somebody anticipated what I was going to say. They had a guest, and he was the son of a Russian father and a French mother. And he was born in 1934, and a lot of his life was spent in New York City, where he grew up after the war, and then also in Paris. And eventually, his family moved to Russia, where his father was originally from. His name was Vladimir Posner, and this guy was good. At 11 o'clock, when Vladimir Posner was a guest on Nightline with Ted Koppel, I would be screaming at the TV at Posner because he was slick. His English was better than yours, but he was a Ruskin. Sorry, Albina. He was a Russian. And he would continually be an apologist during the time of the Cold War, in the 80s, when we didn't know it was coming to its conclusion, but he would be an apologist, and he would talk about how peaceful the Soviet Union was when they invaded Afghanistan, and how they are only trying to help those people. And you'd watch him, and you'd hear him speak, and you'd hear him tell all these lies. Sorry, Albina, if he was a friend of yours. All these things you knew were totally, patently untrue. Do you remember Vladimir Posner? Anybody besides me? I've lost the audience. I mean, no, I did that in the introduction, I know, but nobody remembers him. Where were you? You weren't up at 11 o'clock. Maybe you got wise and went to sleep. But he would say these things that were so outrageously, and you knew they were false. And you go, but later on in life, he kind of backtracked on a lot of it. In doing the research for the sermon, I found out he kind of recanted. You know, I said a lot of things I really shouldn't have. I didn't mean, et cetera, et cetera. We knew he was Russian, but he sounded like an American. And that's because he grew up for a lot of his life in America. Which brings us back to 2 Timothy 4 and 2 Peter 3. I kind of admire the guy, Vladimir Posner. Kind of admire him for a great acting job, because, he was smooth, he was slick, he was good. Let's turn to what did I say? I said 2 Timothy 4, I meant 2 Timothy 3. Disregard what I said previous. Go to chapter 3. And we've all already read about the horrific times that will come. the horrific times that will come in the first couple of verses in the last days, right? But jump over to verse 13, because this is within the context as well. Evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Now, also notice 2 Peter Let me loop in one other thing. 2 Peter chapter 3. We read in the first part in verse 3, scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Jump ahead to the last part of the chapter. And verse 17. You therefore, beloved, since you know this beforehand, beware lest any of you fall from your own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked. In both of these cases, in speaking about the last days, it's talking about lawlessness, hatred toward God, and deception. I'm not going to go back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, but you know what it says. But it is a time that is going to be filled with lawlessness, the embracement of lawlessness, and deception. What greater way to deceive mankind about the coming of Jesus Christ, as it says in 2 Peter chapter 3, than to convince people that he's already in Jerusalem, sitting in the house of God, guiding mankind's affairs, along with the power of the state and the media and the church. Look how far we've gone in the last 6 months with just the power of the government and the media. There hasn't been any effective church power. Hasn't been there. When these three are combined, then you'll see, when you read Revelation 13, why the whole world will marvel, along with some miraculous power. You combine all three of those, which we've never had, really. Even in the resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, you've never had all three working together. So, four principles of watching prophecy: law, people, yourself, and then the fourth point, combining media, state, and church. These are four principles to keep your attention focused on in Bible prophecy.